Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. Doctors are encouraging parents to do their research about getting students vaccinated as the school year begins. For preteens and teens, that includes learning more about the human papillomavirus, or HPV, vaccine. We'll hear comments from John Dunn, Assistant Medical Director for Preventative Care at Group Health. We'll also hear about the controversial move to eliminate the entire Profanity Peak wolf pack from Northeast Washington. A new review of studies on predator control to protect livestock shows little scientific evidence that killing large predators such as wolves, mountain lions, or bears actually reduces livestock loss. In some cases, it's increased the loss. And are cricket crunchies in your munching future? Tom Bonsi introduces us to Charles Wilson of Cricket Flowers in Portland. This is The Bridge for the week of September 29th. We begin with two stories from the Daily Historian. Visitors to Clatsop County Circuit Court in downtown Astoria are noticing tougher security. The intent is to improve public safety, but the new protocol has divided the presiding judge and the district attorney and sheriff. Kyle Spurr has more.
Visitors to Clatsop County Circuit Court in downtown Astoria are noticing tougher security. The intent is to improve public safety, but the new protocol has divided the presiding judge and district attorney and sheriff. Visitors are now directed through a metal detector at one secure entrance off Commercial Street. Two other entrances on the south side of the building are blocked off with security signs, although the entrance on the bottom floor is still open to the disabled. The change was approved in February by a court security advisory committee over the objections of the district attorney, sheriff, and interim county manager, who all wanted more discussion over security design. Judge Paula Brownhill, who presides over Circuit Court, said the heightened security was timed for the death penalty trial of Randy Lee Roden, which began in court this week. Some at the county do not necessarily see the change as a permanent solution. District Attorney Josh Marquis, Sheriff Tom Bergen, and former interim county manager Rich Mays all voted against the change in February as members of the court security advisory committee. Each official agrees the courthouse needs stronger security, but they want to consider alternatives. They thought everyone agreed more study was needed before launching the new security plan. Kyle Spurr of the Daily Historian for Coast Community Radio.
New signs will help Clatsop County residents let emergency responders know if they need help during a crisis. Clatsop County residents can now tell emergency responders if they need help or if they're okay, all with the flip of a sign. September is National Preparedness Month. County agencies and businesses are partnering to start a sign program. The signs have OK written on one side and HELP written on the other, and they're being offered for free to residents to use after an emergency. A resident can put the sign in a front window to help emergency responders check on residents door-to-door after an earthquake, tsunami, or winter storm. Clatsop County Emergency Manager Tiffany Brown said she ordered 5,000 signs that were delivered last week to various public and private entities. Already some places are running out of signs. Another 2,500 signs could be ordered soon. Brown said the program is a simple way to empower the community in an emergency situation. After an event like an earthquake or severe winter storm, first responders will be in high demand and short supply, she said. The signs can mitigate injury and loss of life by helping local agencies use what relatively few resources they have in an efficient manner. This story was also filed by Kyle Spurr for the Daily Historian. The school year has started, and the state of Washington is asking that school-age children be up to date on their immunizations against such highly contagious diseases as measles. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention also recommends a number of vaccinations aside from those required for the school, including the seasonal flu vaccine. John Dunn is the Assistant Medical Director for Preventive Care at Group Health. He says he knows that for parents, these decisions can be tough, but they are important.
We like to have them be a part of a decision-making process. I, as a provider, don't want to dictate what people are going to do. I want to talk to them about what's going on. I want to let them know about their options, and I want to let them make up their own mind.
He says group health is a proponent of immunization, but realizes some parents don't immunize children for religious reasons, and others are worried about potential health problems associated with some vaccines, though those risks are reported to be very small. The CDC recommends older children also are vaccinated against the human papillomavirus, or HPV. Dunn says the HPV vaccine is often misunderstood. In the short term, it only seems to be immunizing against a sexually transmitted infection, but the vaccine is meant for longer-term prevention of cervical cancer in women and other kinds of cancers in men.
Because there's a disconnect between what it is that the virus causes right away and what it is that we're really worried about and really trying to prevent, a lot of people don't understand exactly why it is that we think it's so important.
According to the CDC, nearly half of boys ages 13 to 17 received at least one dose of the HPV vaccination last year. Group Health has created a foundation to make immunizations accessible to families that want them but otherwise can't afford them. And with the start of the school year in Oregon, there's renewed interest in a bill passed unanimously by the Oregon legislature last year aimed at improving programs for 57,000 English learning students. Many school districts have struggled to provide proper instruction for English language learners, and the question remains, has House Bill 3499 addressed those students' needs? For now, the state has set up an advisory board to watch where funding for ELL programs is going. Wei-Wei Liu, a former program director in Beaverton, says transparency is an important component of the bill.
This bill tries to create a clear guideline for school districts to realize what is appropriate funding for English language learners and what is not.
Before the bill was passed, the state had no uniform budget reporting for these programs, making it hard to determine where ELL program money was going. The bill allocates more than $12 million every 2 years to districts' ELL programs. Advocates are waiting for the Oregon Department of Education to produce a plan of action for intervention in low-performing school districts. Some parents feel the legislation is too little, too late. Maria Delgado is a Latino parent organizer for Unite Oregon. She took her son and daughter out of their Portland high school because of the school's ELL program. Delgado spoke through a translator about her daughter's experience.
I noticed that she didn't need to be in the program because she was already bilingual. And she was basically wasting her education time. She wasn't finishing her requirements for graduation by being in this program.
Only half of Oregon students in English learning programs currently graduate from high school. The State Department of Education has targeted 40 school districts for ELL improvement. Even with closer monitoring of ELL programs, another issue still remains. Lou says the next step is to provide a way to engage parents of ELL students who may not understand English themselves.
This parent is totally isolated from the school activities, and any support that the school is trying to provide or any support that the parent might need to help the child, the English language learner in this case, to make progress.
One of the major challenges facing Oregon public schools today is that Oregon's economy has been on the upswing. In some Oregon school districts, the strong economy is contributing to a serious shortage of teachers. For the rest, that shortage is likely to be just around the corner.
Michelle Oakes helps Bend Lapine and other Central Oregon school districts with teacher recruitment and retention.
The teacher shortage is here. What we're finding is we have fewer teachers attending job fairs. We have fewer teachers applying for some of the positions.
Oakes says at a statewide teacher job fair last spring, attendance was way down and recruiters from Alaska and Hawaii had come to Oregon offering jobs and moving expenses. Would-be teachers are finding other kinds of jobs that pay a lot better. Bend Lapine has traditionally had no problems filling vacancies. The message from its Visitors Bureau has gotten through.
When some people think of Bend, they dream about its endless outdoor opportunities. Other teachers think about the possibilities that come from visiting a hip urban oasis.
But even here, schools are scrambling to find physics, English as a second language, and music teachers. While there is no general teacher shortage in Bend yet, the district is trying to get out in front of the issue with a new compensation program. Starting salaries were raised to $40,000. Salaries top out at over $70,000. Traditionally, it took 17 years to get there. Now, Superintendent Shay Michelson says teachers can skip rungs on the ladder by getting performance-based raises.
We're not using performance in the notion of a single test score. We don't think that measures the full complexity of the art and science of teaching. We use multiple dimensions to look at that. So it's a paneled review process, similar to the National Board, where we're looking at student work samples, we're looking at video evidence of a teacher's instruction.
By skipping steps on the salary scale, a teacher in Bend can get a one-time raise of up to $10,000. Lindsay Keeley is a second-year kindergarten teacher in Bend.
When I say, "Are you ready for a great day?" you're going to say, "Oh, yeah." Are you ready for a great day?
Yeah!
When Keeley heard about having to demonstrate her skills in a rigorous peer review process, she said, "Bring it on."
I like that this component allows you to become really reflective. And so not only are you being evaluated, but you're evaluating yourself. And so you're able to think, how can I get better as an educator? This isn't, did I get it right or not?
Nationally, 50% of all educators leave the classroom in the first 3 years. Ben's Michelson was worried about retaining staff, so the district is providing mentors to all first and second year teachers.
The real heart behind this new change is this notion of no longer should you just get a key to your classroom and start teaching. What can we do to continue the work that they've done in their master's program and they move forward to really have that mentoring and that coaching support?
Other districts are using mentors. Springfield has a program similar to Ben's, but Oregon Education Association President Hannah Vandering says lack of support, a statewide average salary that starts at $38,000, and public criticism combine to lower morale among teachers.
The attacks on public education have had a huge impact on individuals who really have a passion and want to be educators. Unfortunately, some of our own members are discouraging their own children from going into public education.
There is a statewide shortage of special education, ESL, and substitute teachers. Several rural districts in southern and eastern Oregon report finding no applicants for some positions, including elementary school teachers. Meanwhile, enrollment in teacher education programs is down. The writing is on the blackboard. Here's a startling statistic. One-third of all school district employees in Oregon are eligible for retirement benefits right now.
There's definitely a looming shortage.
Randy Hitz is dean of the School of Education at Portland State.
A lot of people held off retirements because the economy was not particularly good. Their private investments weren't good, but the stock market's recovering and the economy's looking pretty good. And I think the boomers are going to see the possibility of retiring and they're going to do it.
Hitz says school districts have to continue to come up with new ways to recruit young people to teaching.
What I hope they don't do is I hope they don't lower the standards. That's historically what we've tended to do in education, and I think it doesn't serve children very well.
Despite all the problems, the teaching profession does have a card up its sleeve. As kindergarten teacher Lindsay Keeley sees it, it's the idealism card.
If someone wants to impact future generations, teaching is a perfect career to get into. You have to have a huge heart. You have to have lots of patience and just knowing that every day that you're in the classroom, you're making a big difference and you're changing our world.
For an idealist looking to teach, to quote the Oregon Confederation of School Administrators, you're in a buyer's market. In Bend, I'm Jacob Lewin.
Oregon farm workers are joining advocates across the nation to petition the Environmental Protection Agency, calling on them to ban the use of a toxic pesticide called chlorpyrifos. The feds banned home use of the insecticide in 2000, but have allowed use on farms to treat crops such as apples, nuts, and corn, and it's even used on wood fences and golf courses. Ramon Ramirez is the president of Oregon's Farm Workers Union, PCUN. He says the pesticide is widely used on the West Coast, and farmworking communities up and down the coast are feeling the tragic effects.
We're seeing an increase in cancer rates among farmworkers, and we have to stop it now.
And we believe that by petitioning to the EPA, we can make our case to the public and also to the government that it needs to do more to protect phone users.
Chlorpyrifos is a nerve toxin proven to cause neurological deficits in children who live near the fields. In 2015, the EPA tried to negotiate with the pesticide industry to reduce its use or limit human exposure, but the talks failed. Advocates say they're prepared to take the issue to court if the EPA does not take action soon. Ramirez says the life expectancy of farm workers is drastically shorter than that of the general public. However, he says there's never been a national health study on the long-term effects of pesticides on farm workers, making it difficult for workers to bring their case against the hazardous chemicals to the EPA. Ramirez says he's also concerned about effects of chlorpyrifos on the general public.
By not having a national study done, it's hard to scientifically prove that the high cancer rate among farm workers exists and to pinpoint it for these specific reasons, and that being that farm workers work on a daily basis with a number of toxic chemicals.
If the gender pay gap continues to close at its current rate, women will reach pay equity with men in 2059, according to a new report from the American Association of University Women, called The Simple Truth About Gender Pay Gap. The report finds full-time working women are slowly closing the disparity, making about 80% nationally of what their male counterparts make. Marilyn Watkins, policy director for the Economic Opportunity Institute, says the issue isn't just that women are paid less for the same job title. Often, as in the technology field, they're shuffled into lower-paying positions.
Men might get the job as coders, which are the most highly paid jobs, and women get slotted into the testing part, where they still have to have a lot of computer and technology skills, but they just get paid less, and they don't have the opportunity to really rise up in the organization either.
In Washington State, full-time working women make 79% of what men working full-time make, according to the report. Watkins says Washington State could strengthen its equal pay laws by looking to other states. This summer, Massachusetts passed one of the strongest equal pay laws in the country, which makes sure companies pay equally for comparable jobs and job requirements.
For example, cafeteria workers and custodians might be deemed comparable jobs, even though one is traditionally female and gets paid a lot less than the traditionally male custodial jobs.
Equal pay legislation, such as bills that provide for wage transparency, have failed in Washington's legislature over the past few years. Watkins says the paid sick leave initiative on this year's ballot could boost Washington women in the workplace. The report also found that African American women make about two-thirds and Hispanic or Latina women make about half of what white men make nationwide. Watkins says it's important to think about how policies that close the gender pay gap affect women of color as well.
We really do need to include a racial equity lens as well as a gender equity lens when we're looking at policies. All of these policies will really help end some of the racial inequities as well as some of the gender inequities.
When Washington State wildlife officials announced they would eliminate the Profanity Peak wolf pack, they were operating under a new management plan that came about after months of deliberation with various stakeholders, ranging from livestock producers to conservation groups. There were some parties left out of the discussion. Correspondent Emily Schwing reports.
Donnie Martorello is in charge of the state's wolf policy. He says ultimately the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife is a conservation organization.
We wouldn't be removing the wolf pack if we believed at all that there was a conservation impact or an impact of recovering the species in Washington.
He says the state's decision to eliminate Profanity Peak wolves is in keeping with protocols that were agreed to by nearly 20 stakeholders that make up the state's Wolf Advisory Group, or WAG. Among them is Washington-based Wildlife and Wildlands Conservation Group, Conservation Northwest. Spokesman Chase Gannell calls the state's management plan the best in the nation.
It requires ranchers to conduct conflict avoidance measures and other methods to reduce or prevent depredations. And it does allow, as a last resort, the lethal removal of wolves. And we think, as a whole, that plan is better than other states. It's learned from the experiences in the Rockies and elsewhere, and we're proud to support it.
WAG members include cattle and sheep ranchers, private citizens, and other conservation and animal rights groups like Defenders of Wildlife and the Humane Society of the United States. But some organizations believe WAG members have compromised too much when it comes to wolf recovery and conservation. Roughly 80 people gathered at the state capitol last week to protest the state's decision to shoot and kill the entire Profanity Peak wolf pack. Amaruk Weiss is the West Coast wolf organizer for the Center for Biological Diversity. It's one organization that's not represented among the 18 members of the WAG.
We've seen this over the years, wherever there are wolves, when groups are coming to the table and compromising to that degree, wolves are the losers.
There are other groups that have also been left out of the conversation. An elder from Western Washington's Cowlitz Indian tribe complained that exterminating the wolf pack violates Native American treaty and religious rights. According to the Attorney General's office, Washington's Department of Fish and Wildlife is operating in compliance with federal and state law. As for tribes, there are no tribal courts that have any subject matter jurisdiction over these management actions, wrote Neil Wise, senior counsel for the Attorney General, in a letter dated August 29th. The U.S. government and tribal leaders signed treaties in the 1850s so that tribal law applies on tribal land. Essentially, Indian reservations are independent nations. The Profanity Peak Wolf Pack's territory is just north of the Colville Indian Reservation. Vice Tribal Chairman Mel Tenasket says the tribe has their own wolf management plan.
So basically what we're saying is that state, you have your plan, tribes have our plan, and we hope that we recognize each other's jurisdiction and sovereignty.
Washington stakeholders plan to review that state's wolf management protocols this winter. In Oregon, state wildlife officials also heard from stakeholders. A 2010 report describes those comments as highly polarized. The state killed four Oregon wolves from the Imnaha pack last spring. Idaho's wolf management plan allows ranchers to kill wolves that kill their cattle. I'm Emily Schwing reporting.
Killing predators such as wolves, coyotes, and bears to protect livestock has little scientific evidence to back it up, according to a new study. The research, called Predator Control Should Not Be a Shot in the Dark, is published in this month's Frontier of Ecology and Environment journal. Researchers from the University of Wisconsin and two other schools evaluated 24 studies to determine whether they followed the scientific method and found half weren't sufficiently rigorous. Mike Peterson is the executive director of the Lands Council. He says taking out the alphas in wolf packs, for instance, would have the opposite effect of protecting livestock.
There's been a theory that if you take out the leading female or male, that could actually damage the wolf pack and cause more predation.
Over the past month, Washington State wildlife officials have been killing members of the Profanity Peak Wolf Pack, blamed for the deaths of 13 cattle in the northeastern part of the state. The state plans to kill all remaining 11 members of the pack. The Profanity Peak Pack makes up more than a tenth of about 90 endangered gray wolves in Washington. Peterson says more consideration should be given to the small number of wolves and their territory.
There needs to be some places on our public lands where wolves have a higher priority than cattle, and this would be one of them in the cattle range and roadless area in a proposed wilderness area.
Ranchers make use of federal grazing allotments in the Colville National Forest, where the Profanity Peak Pack is found. Peterson adds the Forest Service is working with an outdated plan that could have led to the conflict between grazing land and wolf territory in the area. And conservation groups argue in a new lawsuit that Oregon violated its own Endangered Species Act by removing the endangered status of gray wolves. The lawsuit was filed coinciding with preparations to update the state's wolf management plan. The Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission removed the wolf from the endangered species last year, saying the species had rebounded within significant portions of its range. But the Center for Biological Diversity's West Coast Wolf organizer, Amarok Weiss, said that wolves are still in danger of extinction in Oregon and should not have been delisted. The group argues in its brief that wolves occupy only 8% of their natural range in the state of Oregon. So, maybe you're not hungry as a wolf, but are you ready for a little nosh about now? How about some roasted crickets in cayenne spice or original flavor? A food industry startup from Oregon is ready to sell you something completely different for your mid-morning snack. Tom Bonsi reports the two-year-old company has ambitions to grow an edible insect industry in the Pacific Northwest.
Cricket Flowers started by selling finely ground crickets sourced from wholesalers in the Midwest and back east. The powder, which has a slightly nutty flavor, can be a protein supplement or gluten-free baking ingredient.
There's been a lot of great market validation over the last year for the entire edible insect industry and also for our company at Cricket Flowers.
That's company founder and CEO Charles Wilson in Portland. Wilson now aspires to expand beyond retail by building a processing plant locally. But education and recruitment of farmers interested in rearing food-grade crickets or mealworms comes first.
It would really be a game changer if we could build that regional supply chain.
Cricket Flowers just won a $15,000 prize in a clean tech business competition to get the new idea hopping. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
Cricket Flowers took the top prize earlier this month in a clean tech business competition put on by Portland State University. Wilson described the $15,000 prize check as a good start to get off the ground and running with the new idea. Wilson said the winnings will seed a new entity called the Edible Insect Foundation. The 2015 University of Oregon Law School graduate estimated a full-scale processing plant would require $200,000 to $400,000 to build. The entrepreneur regularly visits trade shows, museums, and food fairs to offer consumers free samples and preach about the nutrition and environmental sustainability advantages of eating insects. Cricket Flowers will have a booth at the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry Harvest Festival in Portland on October 2nd. That's it for this edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is available as a podcast on our website at coastradio.org. I'm Kate Brister. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time on The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.